to the Lawyer Education Series. My name is Katie Kelso and I'm the Solicitor in Charge of Care and Protection at Legal Aid New South Wales. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that I am on, land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to Elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the land from which you are listening today. Today I'm joined by Eleanor Canning, who is a Senior Care and Protection Solicitor at our Parramatta Office of Legal Aid, and Adrian Nasty, a Senior Legal Officer at the Department of Communities and Justice. In a former life, Adrian was a lawyer for both parents and children in private practice. Welcome to you both and thank you for joining me to talk about working with the Department of Community Services. Now, this is quite a big topic, but we're going to try and explore the most important things for child representatives to know when they are representing children in care proceedings. Adrian, I'm going to start with you. Lawyers need to be familiar with the concept of DCJ being a model litigant, don't they?
Hi, thanks Katie, and thanks for having me here today. It's a pleasure. Look, they do. The model litigant policy is a policy that applies to government legal practitioners, of which I'm one, and their government clients. So in this context, the department or FACS or DCJ, as people have known it by in the past, is bound by those obligations. And look, in a general sense, their obligations to act honestly and fairly in accordance with the highest professional standards, and their obligations that go beyond a lawyer's ethical obligations, and acting in accordance with the law and court rules. So some examples that might apply is that acting promptly in a matter and not causing unnecessary delay, acting consistently with your instructions, but not pursuing spurious arguments or claims that lack merit. Another example might be providing information to a court that may be adverse to your client's interests, that doesn't necessarily support your case, but really is about presenting all of the information before, in this case, the children's courts, the court can make the best decision in the interest of a child.
So, Adrian, on a day-to-day basis, how does that look for you as a legal officer with DCJ?
I often liken our role as a legal officer as akin to counsel assisting in, for example, a coronial inquiry or another type of inquiry or Royal Commission, where really it's about providing all of the available information to the best of your ability before the court. And that information, as I said earlier, might be information that isn't particularly helpful to your position. If the department has a particular view about what should happen in relation to placement of a child or contact, nevertheless, it's our obligation to put all of the information before a court. So there might be information that is positive and or negative in relation to, for example, a parent, or it might be information that doesn't necessarily accord with our instructions at that time. And the reason for that is really about not advancing a particular set of instructions blindly or to the bitter end. It's about ensuring the court has everything before it in order to make the most complete decision for a child in a care matter.
And at the end of the day, I mean, we're all working towards the same thing, aren't we? We're looking to make the best possible arrangements that are consistent with the safety, welfare and well-being of the child. Are there any particular cases or any other resources that you can think might be relevant to this particular aspect for practitioners to read? I'm thinking in particular that some of the cases around costs are quite important, because I think you can see in those cases some of the consequences of not being a model litigant.
I know there's a decision of Tanner, which was a decision of Her Honour Magistrate Sheedy in the Children's Court, which looked at this cost issue, and I think in that case there was a particular position advanced by the Secretary in relation to whether restoration was realistic to a parent, notwithstanding that a clinic assessment had formed the view that restoration was not realistic. And that case ultimately led to, for a number of reasons, but in particular that position, a costs order being made against the secretary. So I think it's a useful example because really being the model litigant, amongst other things, requires government legal practitioners and government clients to be flexible in the face of new information and not advancing particular positions not consistent with the preponderance of the evidence. So I think that is a good example. But ultimately, I think the best advice I can give people working in this space is that it's about acting honestly, and it's about acting fairly, and it's about putting forward a position which allows the court to make the most complete decision for a child, and about putting all of the information before a court, the good and the bad.
And I think that's consistent really with what your obligations are under the solicitor's rules anyway, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
In terms
that's
of not right. being a mere mouthpiece for your client, making sure that you're running cases as efficiently as, yeah. as possible.
Exactly. And your first obligation ultimately, and this applies to any lawyer, is to the court. So that's that goes without saying.
Mm. Okay, Adrian, I'm going to stay with you on this one, and I'm going to ask you to set the scene a little bit for those people listening that may not be familiar with what an FSP is, funded service provider, or an NGO. Do you want to give us a bit of an explanation about what exactly an FSP is or what an NGO is and how they fit into these care proceedings that the practitioners are going to be dealing with?
Look, I think the best way to set the scene is to explain what the scenario was prior to this terminology being widely used. So an FSP stands for, as you say, a funded service provider, and an NGO, which is a term I think familiar to most people more widely, it's been a term used for decades internationally, stands for a non-government organisation. The confusion often arises because in care, the terms are often used interchangeably, but for today's purposes, I'll probably stick with using the term FSP. So if I say the other term NGO, please forgive me. Prior to FSPs and NGOs being a sort of very big player in case management of children's matters in New South Wales, and their kids who are either in out-of-home care or their children who are being restored to their parents under an order of the Children's Court, the case management was predominantly performed by caseworkers within community services. In the last decade or so, there's been a shift to organisations outside of the department, traditionally known as NGOs, and there are many examples that people may be familiar with, for example, Barnardo's or Catholic Care, but there are many others. I'm just using those two as an example. They would start performing the role of day-to-day case management, the same role that a caseworker within community services would be performing, for example, for a child who is in foster care pursuant to an order of the Children's Court. That has become much more prevalent, and there's been various legislative changes that and policy changes that have allowed that to occur. So we now have a situation as at this year in 2021 where a large number of matters that, for example, go before the Children's Court, either before it came to the Children's Court, if it was a Section 90 application, that child on a day-to-day basis was being case managed by a non-government organisation. So they would be performing the functions of what a caseworker would have ordinarily have done in the past. So, for example, they would be liaising with a child's carer, they would be arranging contact with significant family members or other persons, they would be assisting the parents if the plan was a plan towards a restoration, for example, they would be assisting parents with referral to services, arranging appointments and the like. The FSP would obviously still have a relationship with community services around certain decisions that need to be made, because ultimately, dependent on the order that was made, but I'm using the example of a child being placed under the parental responsibility of the minister here, even though an FSP or an NGO had day-to-day casework responsibility for a child, they would not have delegated parental responsibility. Those big decisions about where a child lived or who they had contact with or major medical treatment would still need to be something that the department or the secretary would need to have a role in. So really it's about, I suppose the best way of describing it is that it's using other organisations to assist in the casework of children and not just reliant on children being managed or caseworked by caseworkers within community services.
So is it right to say that we and practitioners might see FSPs being involved pretty early on in proceedings and then post-proceedings and also in the context of Section 90? So it's something to be mindful for really from day one?
It is, because really depending on the application that's brought before the Children's Court, I'll use the Section 90 example. There may be a situation where a child has been in an out-of-home care placement with a family member or in foster care, and there is a particular case plan goal that is pursued at a certain point to say, well, we're now looking at restoration to a parent. And that case plan goal can be pursued by an FSP or in consultation with DCJ. And if that's the case, then there may be or steps are taken to bring an application before the Children's Court to pursue a restoration to that parent. So the FSP would have already been involved managing the placement, and they now would file evidence in the Children's Court proceedings to support a plan to restore that child to a parent. And obviously it would be subject to the various tests under the Act to make sure that the court was of the view that there was a significant change. So the FSP would have a role in gathering that evidence to support this new course of action. Another example might be where a child's removed for the first time and there's no history with any departmental involvement. The department might, during the course of those proceedings, refer casework responsibility to an FSP or a non-government organisation. That, in my experience, doesn't ordinarily happen until the matter is resolved or towards the end of a matter being resolved in the Children's Court where the plan is clearer. But an FSP will often get involved during the course of the proceedings fairly early on to do the casework, as it were, to arrange appointments, to conduct your analysis, to supervise contact and the rest of it. So even though they're doing that, ultimately, the minister at that point still has parental responsibility and has a say as to what goes on during the course of those proceedings.
Okay, and I'm just going to pick up on what you've said there in terms of parental responsibility, but can you talk us through these terms, primary and secondary case management responsibility, and what that means and what we need to know about that?
All right, so in terms of what primary casework responsibility is, in the example that I gave earlier, an FSP or an NGO will often be given primary casework responsibility for a child or a family. When they exercise primary case responsibility, the primary casework relationship is between the FSP and the child and their carer and their parents. So they might be delivering individualised casework support, recognising and developing strengths and capabilities of the child, their parents and their kin, providing practical assistance and support to a child and a family, and providing information and casework to the department, who in that example will be exercising what's called secondary case responsibility. They will be receiving that information from the FSP and recording it on our systems. And really, depending on the information that the department receives, there'll be steps taken either to change the case plan goal, to make referrals, to look at placement options, or to see whether that child should remain in their current placement or whether there should be a different plan adopted, i.e. guardianship, restoration, or otherwise. So look, in simple terms, primary case responsibility is really caseworkers within an FSP exercising day-to-day casework functions that would ordinarily be provided by a caseworker within the department. They report back to us about how a child is progressing. And depending on the information that we receive, certain actions are taken. What needs to be emphasised is that they do not have parental responsibility. Ultimately, it's the minister that does. So any major decisions that need to be made need to be done in consultation with the department.
Very helpful to know. Eleanor, I'm going to come to you now. As a child representative, there are some rules that we need to know about how we can interact with DCJ, aren't there? Do you want to talk us through those?
Thanks, Katie. The rules apply whether we're representing children or adults in care proceedings. And what we need to remember is that this is first and foremost a court proceedings in which the Department of Community Services is a party and the caseworkers have a lawyer, which is the lawyer who we need to contact as either representing children or parents. The only exception to that rule is when we're organising appointments to speak with child clients. My personal practice is that I would always contact the lawyer first, and that might mean a quick email to Adrian to say I need to organise an appointment with the Brown children. Now, I don't expect Adrian to bring the Brown children to my office, and he would more than likely say, I'm happy for you to contact the caseworker directly to organise that appointment. That's really the only contact that we should be having with caseworkers. It's not uncommon for clients to expect us to be able to go to case conferences with them or pass on information directly to caseworkers, but we must remember that they are legally represented in these proceedings and any correspondence that we need to have must go through their legal representative.
And it's the same scenario if a DCJ lawyer was to approach your client if you were acting for a parent, wouldn't it be, Eleanor? You wouldn't want a DCJ lawyer speaking to your client if you were representing them.
That's exactly right, Katie. And it's often frustrating for our clients who feel unprotected in going to meetings with caseworkers, and they think that that's where the unfairness arises. But unfortunately, we can't go to those meetings with the caseworkers just at the same as Adrian couldn't approach our clients and speak to them without us there.
So that's the situation in relation to caseworkers from DCJ. But let's talk a little bit more about how FSPs, who can have some of that case management responsibility as we've just discussed, can sort of add an additional layer of complexity. And let's talk about how, as child reps, what you need to know and some strategies as to how you might be able to address this. Now, we've got really important obligations as child representatives under the Act, don't we, in terms of making sure that all relevant information is adduced to assist the court to make the best possible decision for children, don't we? Do you want to talk us through that a little bit in this context?
Sure. It's a huge responsibility as a child representative in care proceedings, and we really have to be ready to run a case in several different directions at once. And that means we have to test not only the case brought by the department, but we also have to test the case brought, often different cases brought by different parents. That includes at times testing evidence that may be relied on that comes from FSPs. And the thing I'd like to remind people is not to accept the evidence filed by departmental witnesses at face value. And I accept everything Adrian said in relation to their very strict obligations as model litigants, but I think we all accept that there are times when perhaps mistakes are made, that caseworkers might be rushed in preparing their evidence, they might have overlooked something. So it's extremely valuable as an ILR that we really go through and test all the evidence of the department, expecting that they might not have carried out their model litigant responsibilities. And that means subpoenaing the file, going through the file, looking for things that might have been missed. They might be file notes or additional contact reports that hadn't been filed in the department's case. And we have to do the same for the casework files of a funded service provider if there's one engaged in the proceedings.
So it can also mean asking questions, can't it? Asking, requesting information, asking for certain documents. And I think the point that we're trying to make here, Eleanor, isn't it, in relation to FSPs, is that there might be two points, not for us to contact, But there might be two sets of files, I guess, that really need to be looked at, and we need to make sure that that evidence is before the court if it's going to assist the court.
Absolutely. If a matter's proceeding, I would always issue a subpoena for the departmental file, but also for the casework file of the funded service provider. That might include a separate subpoena for the file in relation to carers, if they are foster carers through a funded service provider. We have to be strategic in working out what information we're trying to access and what is the best way to address the subpoena to access that information. But I would just remind everyone that if casework is being carried out during the proceedings by a funded service provider, the bulk of the information that you will need will be in the FSP file. It will not be in the departmental casework file.
That's a very good, important thing for people to know, isn't it? That when you're thinking about issuing subpoenas and evidence gathering, you've got to make sure you're issuing the right subpoena to the right organisation. Now, let's talk about some of the differences. So Adrian, obviously, is a lawyer for the Department of Communities and Justice, and he takes instructions from caseworkers and casework managers. But that's not the situation in relation to FSPs, is it?
No. And look, just to touch on something that Eleanor just said, I have taken the view that an FSP, if I'm in a matter acting for the department and there's an FSP involved and there's caseworkers who are dealing with the parents, that they are a witness in our case. And that if the matter is ultimately contested, that there is a reasonably high expectation that the court will need to hear their evidence because they're at the coalface dealing with parents on a day-to-day basis, and that often in a court proceeding, the caseworker from the department may not have even met the parents until the court proceedings commenced. So it stands to reason that the worker from the FSP or their manager will be the one who will need to answer questions. So my practice has often been from the outset in a matter to ensure that those individuals file evidence in a matter, swear affidavits or affirm affidavits, so that it's clear from the outset that they're required, in the event that the matter is defended, to answer questions in relation to casework that's been carried out in the matter. And I agree with Eleanor that ultimately the court needs the best information available, and it's not about providing that via the department in a caseworker from the department's affidavit. It's about providing it directly from the source. So I think that if it allows the court to make the best possible decision with the best possible information, then that information should come directly from the source itself. So, Katie, to answer your question, though, about their party status, it's correct. They're not parties in the sense that a parent is or a department is. They're witnesses, as I see it, in the department's case, who are supporting our particular position that's expressed in a care plan that's brought before the court. Now, there will be occasions where there may be some areas of disagreement between a funded service provider and the department. I have to say it's not that common, but it does happen in my experience. Ordinarily, the FSP by that stage would have been liaising with the department so regularly around a particular set of court proceedings that it would be unusual for there to be significant differences or a divergence in terms of what the case plan goal is. But ultimately, I make it clear too when I'm acting for the department that those persons are not my client, that they're witnesses the same way a parent would have witnesses in their case that may be supporting their particular view. If there are differences of opinion, then obviously there are ways and means for an FSP to seek their own legal advice. But in my experience, it is rare. And if there is a difference in my view, it usually is a result of there not being information sharing or there not being regular conversations between the department and FSP about what is happening at court and what is happening on the ground.
And I'm just going to pick up on that fact, or what you've just said there, Adrian, which is about if those regular conversations are not happening. And I'm going to ask Eleanor, if those regular conversations are not happening and things are not working, I guess, in terms of that communication. Can you give us some examples of how that can sort of play out in matters and some of the tricky issues that can come up?
Well, the very real risk is that the two agencies or the two arms of the departmental case are working at odds with one another. And I think one of the tricky situations is the FSP workers aren't routinely coming to court. They're not attending DRCs, or except in some circumstances where leave is sought. They're not participating in the proceedings to that extent. And so they're not participating in decision-making around, for instance, should a risk assessment be undertaken in relation to a parent? Should the department support or fund a different type of assessment or a different process? And yet the FSP workers are working on the ground, often in the home with parents, supervising contact, liaising with treaters and service providers for the parent. But they're not necessarily at the table where the decision-making is occurring about what trajectory the litigation should take. And that can often mean that the true nature of the conflict isn't seen until a DRC towards the end of the proceedings, where the funded service provider may come and actually articulate, well, we have a very different view of these parents than the department does. And that, in extreme cases, can mean that they support a restoration that has not been supported by the department, or that they have a very different view in relation to the role that the future role the department should have in a family's life.
So I guess, Eleanor, the flow-on effect of that can be, I guess, worst-case scenario. And we're not talking about a lot of cases, but worst-case scenario, what it can mean is that the evidence that's presented to the court isn't complete, or doesn't perhaps reflect the picture that it needs to reflect. It could mean that proceedings take longer because there's more for the court and for child reps to unpack. But I think the most important thing is that it's going to mean if court proceedings take longer, children are left in situations of uncertainty, not knowing the outcome for a longer period of time sometimes as well. Adrian, there's a really important document that I want you to tell our listeners about. Because really none of this should be happening, but look, things do happen. Talk us through the permanency case management policy rules and practice guidance document.
Yeah, look, thanks, Katie. It's the document really that forms the basis of the department's policy around these issues and how FSPs/NGOs and us as an organisation interact, and what the minimum expectations are between DCJ and funded service providers. The document really talks about working collaboratively between both sides of the fence. It's a document that's publicly available, so maybe that's something that can be linked in the description of the podcast. It's dated November 2019, but it's the extant policy that really determines these things and guides us within the department. In terms of some things that Eleanor raised a moment ago, I think collaboration is really the key between an FSP and the department. And there is a difference between a matter not being in court that's being managed by an FSP in terms of what the interaction is between the department and that organisation. And it is fair to say that in that context, there may be a much less of a frequent interaction between the two organisations because the matter is not in court. The FSP is effectively dealing with the matter on a day-to-day basis, and things will often arise. If things arise, it will arise because of an issue that's arisen in a child's placement or so on. When a matter is in court, however, there is obviously a much sharper focus on collaboration in decision-making between an FSP and the department. And that includes a department and provider participating together in case planning, preparing a care plan, attending a dispute resolution conference, and information exchange. So whilst I'm aware there are matters where often the two organisations have artistic differences, if I can use that expression, the reality in my experience is that when I'm acting for the department, and I encourage all the lawyers that I manage to do this, where the matter's being mediated, that not only should caseworkers attend, but caseworkers who are actually working with parents during the course of a matter should also attend, because they've often got the best information available. They have the information available. They can speak to it. And I'm often told by FSP caseworkers that they really appreciate being part of that process. They don't want to be kept in the dark. And that also includes being provided with material that's filed in the proceedings. From my perspective, there's no impediment when I'm acting for the department. If a parent has brought a Section 90 application, it stands to reason that that evidence that they've filed be brought to the attention of an FSP, if that FSP has been involved in a matter, to consider what that parent is seeking. And that includes all evidence that's filed. So it's about collaboration, it's about information exchange, it's about ensuring that everyone who is in that child's life and in this family's life is available to make decisions at the relevant time.
So I think what you've said there, Adrian, is really important. Communication and collaboration, I think, between the FSP and the department is really what's going to make the difference.
I just want to add, Katie, I think as an ILR, it's important to establish at the commencement or as early as we can towards the commencement of the proceedings if a child is being managed by an FSP, and to seek some guidance from the department as to what the decision-making framework is, what decisions will be made by departmental caseworkers, and what decisions will be made by the FSP. And in when we're acting for parents, it's really helpful that we know that so that we can give our parent clients the right advice in relation to whom they need to provide information to and at what times. I think it can be extremely tricky for our parent clients to understand the dual role, and it can be extremely confronting and distressing to them to think that there are two agencies that they need to deal with. So seeking that clarification from the department at the start of the proceedings is important, and it may mean that information, for instance, if a parent is going to be late to a contact visit or has a medical appointment scheduled or has to miss a urinalysis test, that the parent needs to know who do they give that information to on the day.
And just following on from that, Eleanor, I think the permanency case management policy is a really valuable document for child representatives as well, because it really does set out in quite a lot of detail what the expectations are. And so I think one of the tips for lawyers listening is that if you're starting to see in your matter that perhaps the communication and the collaboration is not there, then that's your document to go and have a look at and see what the expectations are and to follow it up on the basis of what's set out in the policies.
Yeah. And I would even be more proactive than that, Katie, and I would actually say that ILRs should be confirming when filing directions are made, that documents are being provided to FSP caseworkers. So when you get the summary of proposed plan coming in, just confirm and have the departmental representative confirm to the court, yes, that's been provided to the FSP caseworkers. And certainly when we're acting for parents, we need those caseworkers who are on the ground making the daily decisions for our clients to have access to the information that we're filing in our client's case. So just get that confirmation that all of the information as it's flowing through for the proceedings is flowing past the department and straight to the FSP who need it to do the casework.
I think that's a great tip, Eleanor. I think it might assist with trying to resolve or nip some of those issues in the bud before they become really problematic and see those proceedings drawn out and children left in uncertainty. So I think that's a really good one. I just want to move on to post-proceedings, because I think that is quite, as Adrian has said, quite different sometimes in terms of the involvement of FSPs. Now, Adrian, do you want to talk to us a little bit about Section 82 reports and what happens when there's an FSP involved?
In examples where an FSP has primary case responsibility, they will be responsible for drafting a Section 82 report pursuant to an order of the court. So they will provide that report in draft form to the CIFDU or the CSC that has secondary case responsibility, who then review the report and, if necessary, ask any further clarifying questions about information within that report. Those reports are legally reviewed within the department to make sure that they're consistent with, for example, matters raised in the care plan that the court may be interested in knowing post-final orders. And then those reports are filed in accordance with the final order that was made. But in those matters, it's fair to say that the FSP would be drafting that report because, as we've discussed today, they're the ones that have that primary case responsibility and they're dealing with the child and the placement on a day-to-day basis.
And so I think given that we're in a relatively early stage of working through all of the ways that this new sort of relationship between DCJ and the FSPs and the court and all of that, how that fits together, I think I just want to touch upon some of I guess, some of the things that didn't work well initially that perhaps have led to some policy changes for DCJ and the development of that document. Eleanor, do you want to talk to us a little bit about some of the concerns that we've seen, and then we'll talk about what the solutions are and how that's being addressed?
There was certainly a string of cases around 2018 and 2019 which really set out the consequences where differences arise between the views of the department and the views of their FSP partner. The matter of Bridget is it was a published case of CM Sheedy that people should be familiar with, and that's the extreme example of a funded service provider choosing essentially to overturn a care plan and unilaterally make decision making around a restoration without either reference back to the department or to the court. Now, that is an extreme example, and I think arising from a string of decisions, the situation has improved. I think it's improved by virtue of the document Adrian has referred us to, and I think also additional training for the FSPs and the department. However, we do still see significant post-final orders departures by FSPs, and I think partly that arises because care plans are often left quite vague, and the contact requirements in care plans are worded as a minimum, which is the way they're intended to be. But we see a huge amount of decision-making power conferred to FSPs based on a very loosely worded care plan. And my advice to ILRs is, the best thing we can do to prevent that happening is to put as much detail into the care plan before final orders are made. There's little that can be done after that. Our obligations and our duties as an ILR essentially end, but for a Section 82 report. But we're certainly not going to be travelling along with these children and making sure care plans are followed by FSPs. So it's important to make sure that there is much detail is in that care plan as possible. And I would remind everyone that other documents, for instance, if there are clinic assessments or risk assessments or other documents that have been the information around which a care plan has built, those documents may not travel with the child or the young person. It's the care plan is the document that the funded service providers will be building their casework around. So let's make sure all the information around service provision, funding of services for young people, who will be funding the speech therapy, who will be funding the OT, and what will the arrangements for contact be. We have to make sure that all of that is included in the care plan. The other thing we need to include, and this applies to adult clients as well as child clients, is what is the pathway forward for different decision making around contact? Now, we can't necessarily cast into the future and guess when a parent may be able to have more contact or different supervision arrangements for contact, but we should be turning our minds at the time of final orders being made to the types of decision making that will be made, and those sorts of things should be included in the care plan, and that will provide guidance to the FSP caseworkers in the future who may have never been to court, who may have not had any involvement in the development of that care plan, and the hours of negotiations and the binders and binders full of documents that have led to the creation of that care plan. We need to make sure that it's all there in the care plan to assist their casework decision making until these children are 18.
that's, I think, a really good point, Eleanor, and it's important that the information in the care plan is accurate and up to date as well. Sometimes when we're doing amending care plans or updated care plans, some of that information can be retained from earlier care plans, so it's really important it's as up to date as possible. So the devil can be in the detail, and I think the Bridget decision really is a cautionary tale as to what can happen, and we've certainly come a long way since then, and focusing on what Adrian has said, which is all about collaboration and communication, should see that case being the exception, not the rule. Adrian, do you want to talk us through some of your top tips for child representatives? Try and put that hat back on from the time when you used to wear that hat, and tell us about what you would do to try and manage these complex situations.
I think I would echo what Eleanor put earlier, which is to identify very early on who is working with the child and the parents in a matter, and to ask questions about what work they're doing with a parent or both parents. In my experience, if the department is of the view in a matter, for example, that your analysis is important or that contact needs to be managed in a certain way, whilst the matter is before the court, that information will be conveyed to the FSP, and the FSP in nearly all circumstances will abide by that direction, or because there's an understanding that if the matter is before the court, the minister has interim parent responsibility, that they effectively are performing that work, but they're not delegated themselves to make decisions around that. But certainly first to identify who's who in the zoo, as it were. I think the DRC process can be much more fruitful if not only departmental workers are there, but the FSP caseworkers are also involved, so they can ask questions directly of those persons about what they're doing with the family. And I think to continue asking questions of really of the department, and it's our job, I think, as the model litigant to answer them in a complete way, in an open way, in a way that might involve putting a position that is adverse to our interests at times, but to keep asking questions about what is happening with this child or children in a matter, and what persons are involved in making those decisions.
And Eleanor, finally, any words of wisdom?
I'd like people to remember the very important role that they have as ILRs in care proceedings, and the fact that all children in the children's court are represented is an indication of the hugely significant decision-making task that the children's court has in relation to the lives of children and young people. And I'd like our panel members to remember that they are, in a lot of cases, the last line of defence for these children between potentially a really life-changing decision being made one way or the other. And I would like everyone to remember that they are, at the end of the day, lawyers, and to have a forensic approach to their role as the ILR. We are routinely bombarded with information from a social science perspective, and there's lots of reports that we all need to get across, but we are first and foremost lawyers. And so I would encourage a forensic approach, and have an incredibly forensic approach to testing the evidence. And testing the evidence means looking at the decision-making pathways, who made decisions around this child, and what information did they have to feed into that decision-making process. And we have to test all of that so that ultimately the court has the right information for their decision-making process. Mm-hmm.
We're all only human in the end, aren't we? And we're all working towards the same goal, but we've got different responsibilities in terms of our obligations as well. Okay, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.